This week on Comics Therapy, the question was asked, who is your favorite female comic book character? One that inspires you, one that brings hope to you, one that lifts your spirits, one that makes everything a-okay. This week, Reese Marino answers that nerd confession with but one name, Amelia Cole.
That may be a little biased.
But who cares? Amelia Cole is awesome!
Comics Therapy, Episode 20. No reviews, just analysis. Up this week, three new comics from December 4th, 2013. Six Gun Gorilla, number 6, Quantum and Woody, number 6, and Velvet, number 2. As always, we have your nerd confessions and my inner child, if I can promise to follow Andrea's rules. I make no promises. On the couch this week, we have an amazingly insightful conversation with writer Alex DeCampi.
Hey everybody, this is at Charming Red on Twitter, the mom who reads comics, and one third of Comicosity's video podcast, The Hangout. My favorite female superhero is She-Hulk. Jennifer Walters is sassy, fun, well-educated, and let's face it, she can kick a lot of butt. She surrounds herself with friends that she absolutely loves dearly, and I cannot wait for her new book to come out next year.
Welcome to Comics Therapy. Neither Aaron nor I are licensed therapists, so don't take anything we say seriously. The theme of the show this week is power, money, women. Or is it money, power, women? I'm a little unclear as to which comes first in the order of acquisition, but I think we can all agree that all three are desirable and potentially deadly.
Hi, Aaron and Andrea. You asked for our favorite female comic character, and lucky for you, this is something I ponder often because I have a 2-year-old daughter whom I can't wait to introduce to comics. I bought her Batgirl and Supergirl number 1 the week she was born. My favorite female character right now is Barbara Gordon. As Oracle or Batgirl, she exemplifies everything I would want my daughter to be. Smart, tough, and full of grit. She is a great character whom is often not over-sexualized, a great role model for a young girl. While females in comics often pigeonholed into over-sexualized beings, Barbara stands out as a woman who is not only beautiful, but can hold her own against the greatest of heroes. For more insights into comics and video games, check us out at geekswithwives.com or my podcast, Geeks with Wives and Capes, on iTunes and Stitcher. Casey Walsh.
In between comic segments, your very own nerd confessions, celebrating the geeky things we all say, do, read, and enjoy. You know the drill. You share them with us, and we'll share them on an upcoming episode of the show. This week's prompt asks listeners to share their favorite female comics characters. You can still call, Skype, or email your general confessions at any time. All the details are on the website, comicstherapy.com. We are posting the week's prompt on the website as well for your convenience in case you miss it on our social media platforms.
Did you just say social media platforms?
Yes, I'm a social media mogul, and we have social media platforms.
Wow.
Uh-huh.
Okay. That's all you, dude. All you.
We have a Pinterest account.
You
we have
do.
A Tumblr.
Yes, you do.
It's us.
It's all you. In between shows, you can find me on Twitter at Andrea Schock and Aaron at Aaron Myers. And of course, the show account, which Aaron manages, at Comics Therapy. So Aaron, social media maven that you are, how was your week?
It's pretty good. I bought a lot of comics this week.
Unsurprising.
Yes, but I mean a lot of comics.
That's right. It was dumpster diving time, wasn't it?
No, it was a Black Friday sale at the local comic store. 50-cent back issues. And they all came from a collection that a guy brought in and turned into the store. He had 18 long boxes of comics.
That's awesome. Were they sorted ahead of time, or were you one of the first to go through them?
Well, the store owner went through them first and like took out things that were really worth a lot of money.
Good, good.
And then, but he still, he didn't have time to sort through them all. He wanted to sell them as part of the store sale. So he intentionally left like things in there so people would go through all the boxes.
Of course.
Yeah, which is good. I mean, so it wasn't like, you know, totally gone through and was just a bunch of 90s Superman comics or something. But it wasn't like a crazy collection. It was mostly like mid-80s to late 90s, you know, so it's not necessarily the best. But there was just a ton of things that I needed to fill in runs for or things I had missed. And for 50 cents a piece, there, you know, it was totally worth it.
So what was the total number that you bought, or total dollar figure, or if you're... I don't know. Do you have any shame at this point?
No. I spent $300. So I guess, you know, 600 comics.
And they're all bagged and boarded and organized, right?
Yeah. Well, really? they already were.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, because it was somebody's personal collection that already had them bagged and boarded, too.
And they're just piled away where they belong?
I don't have time to. I haven't had time to, like, really organize my collection. So they're in long boxes. They're in the closet, and that's where they'll be for a while.
Huh. Got it.
Yeah. It was fun going through all those boxes, pulling out a ton of stuff, and taking them home, going through them, reading through some.
Any highlights?
I'm sure. I can't remember now. I moved on.
You're more in the moment than I am sometimes. It's pretty hilarious.
Yeah, I live in the now. Yesterday was New Comic Book Day, so that's what I'm thinking about right now.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. There's always time for Old Comic Book Day.
Every other day is Old Comic Book Day.
That's right. How about your week?
Man, my last 36 hours was kind of crazy. Yeah. So, gosh, the last time we talked, I was in Pittsburgh. Now I'm not, right? Okay. The process of getting back to the Bay Area was a little dodgy. Delay in Pittsburgh with the flight getting us across the country meant that we missed the connection in Los Angeles. So spent the night in LA, which is like the first time in my life that I wasn't excited to do that.
Well, at a hotel.
Well,
at airport hotel.
Right. It wasn't actually like spending the night in LA. It was going to the hotel for 4 hours before turning around and going back to the airport for a 6 a.m. flight from L.A. to San Francisco.
Yeah, airports are not a country, or they're just no man's land.
But better than just staying in the terminal.
Yeah, it's true.
You know, for a capstone on a week of crazy travel anyway, like, maybe not my favorite way to do that.
Yes, but you came home, everything was fine.
Everything is totally fine.
Yeah.
And now...
Nice and snug and cozy in the house.
Yes, we don't have any heat.
That's okay. You don't live in Minnesota.
Possible that everybody remembers how well I deal with the cold based on like the whining about the snow, blah, blah, blah. It is 53 degrees in my house right now until the furnace guy comes. So I'm in a blanket. And
you realize that most people would be happy if their house was warmed up to 53 degrees?
You know what? People have already said that to me this morning, and that's bullshit. I'm not talking about outside temperature. I'm talking about inside my home, 5-3 degrees. That's not a normal thing, even for people who are used to the cold. It's chilly, okay? Multiple blankets and sweatpants and, like, mittens and shit. It's cold.
You live such a opulent life. It must
opulent?
Be so nice to, it must be so nice to be you.
Having gloves and mittens and blankets inside my home because it's cold, because I can see my breath is opulent.
Yes.
One of these days, all of this is gonna be like not funny to you anymore, and you're gonna feel really bad. And
I can't imagine that's true. then truly California will have frozen over.
Well, broken off from the rest of the country, right, and like floated away.
Yeah, hope so.
I think that's the master plan.
Right.
But no, it's a good week. Everything is shifting back to normal. I have so much work to catch up on from basically just dicking around for the past week in Pittsburgh. So there's that. But
that's the problem with vacation. When you're an adult, you never really are taking time off. You're just trading time for other time.
Right. But I did read a ton of comics on the plane because there was no Wi-Fi. So I couldn't participate in all of the social media platforms. All I could do was focus on my iPad like the privileged brat that I am.
Mm-hmm.
And I read The Fifth Beatle, which was lovely and beautiful, mm-hmm. and a bunch of other kind of back stuff that I hadn't gotten around to. So good times. It's nice to have forced reading time for 5 hours as you are in a large metal box hurtling across the atmosphere.
Yeah, no, I agree. It's nice to have it when you like all your distractions can kind of be taken away for a little while.
Right.
For a bit. You want to talk about a single comic?
Yes. You want to talk about a comic for 90 seconds and follow all of the direction?
To the letter.
To the letter. That means you're not. Each week I give Aaron 90 seconds to talk about whatever he wants that we don't have time to discuss more deeply. Maybe I need to change that. Maybe leading with Aaron gets to talk about what he wants is what is setting you off.
Those are the words I like to hear, though.
One book, one new comic from the past week that we're not analyzing. I hope everyone paid attention to those words. One new comic from the past week. Are you ready?
Yes.
Go.
So I want to talk about Maximum Carnage Part 13 of 14.
And when did that come out?
1993.
Uh-huh.
When did I get it? Yesterday.
Uh-huh.
It's one of the few, I almost have all the Maximum Carnage series, but it's 14 parts and I'm missing like a few of them. So I found one of the parts I was missing. But that was probably my first introduction to like, I don't think I had read any of the Venom stuff before that or any of the other like symbiote Amazing Spider-Man.
Yeah, I agree.
So like Carnage was my first like symbiote kind of introduction.
My guess is that's true for a lot of people our age.
Maybe, yeah. Well, I don't know. It depends on, like, how early, I guess, you were exposed to Spider-Man. But for some reason, I missed all those McFarlane issues of Venom before that. You know, I read them all after, or even, like, in the 90s, I read them, too. I just read them out of order. So Carnage was, like, the first thing. It was like, whoa, who is this guy? And he was just the coolest. He was the coolest villain at that time for me. You know, 93... would have been 14,
mm-hmm.
which is pretty perfect for these kind of, you know, comics.
Right.
Because I don't know if they hold up, but the characters hold up. They're still good villains. Like, you know, I think the symbiotes are kind of the best arch nemesis for Spider-Man in a lot of ways. Because he was tied to them and rejected them, and he brought them. Like, they're sort of like an alien version of...
Time's up, dude. No one's gonna get to hear what you have to say.
Bummer.
You can finish that thought. I'm feeling generous.
I was going to say, they are the alien version of the mugger, the robber who Spider-Man let go in, like, the first, you know, Amazing Fantasy 15.
Oh, okay. Okay.
I mean?
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Because he still let them loose onto the Earth and has responsibility for all the death and destruction they've caused.
Right. Right. And we all know how he feels about responsibility.
That's true. Yet he keeps making the same mistake.
Anyway.
You want to talk about some new comics?
Some actual new non-loophole comics. Bring it on.
Hey, what's going on? This is Adrian from Adrian and Atlas Have Issues. I was just saying that my favorite comics character is hands down Storm. I mean, she's an African goddess. She can control the weather. And she's insanely skilled at hand-to-hand combat. I mean, honestly, though, she ripped the Morlock's heart out. It doesn't get any more badass than that. Also, can easily hold her own and is a far better leader of the X-Men than Cyclops ever was. But yeah, that's my take. Storm, best female comic character ever. This is Adrian from Adrian Atlas at Issues, and love the show, guys. Comic therapy, pretty badass stuff.
Our first book this week is Six Gun Gorilla number 6, written by Cy Spurrier and drawn by Jeff Stokely. With colors by Andre May and lettering by Steve Wands. Cover art by Ramon Perez. Six Gun Gorilla is published by Boom Studios. This was the final issue of the miniseries.
I'm going to read the recap because, just because I love recaps that I don't have to write. The man called Blue only wanted to die. He sold himself to the Blue Tech PV Corporation, transformed into a psychic TV camera, and sent to a war-torn frontier to entertain the world by dying in style. This is the future. Fiction no longer matters. But Blue was rescued by a gun-wielding gorilla, and since then he struggled to understand his purpose, embroiled in the ongoing war and seduced by self-importance. Only now, after a bizarre vision quest in which he learnt the importance of stories and endings, can Blue see clearly. By coming to terms with the losses in his life, he's discovered a hidden code buried in his own mind, and now sets forth to uncover the secret at the heart of the blister, and to find his own ending. There's also a bounty hunter after him, which is, like, important, and I'm sure we'll talk about it. But that's kind of what you need to know just to follow along if you haven't been reading this.
Yeah, and if you haven't been reading this, I need to talk about the spoilery parts of it. So sorry, but we already give you that warning.
Did we do that this week?
Well, we'll give it to you now. Spoiler alert. That's good enough, because this miniseries really hinges not so much on the characters, but it's a metaphorical story.
Sure.
I mean, which is really kind of the hook that I found extra interesting, because at first you think it's going to be like kind of this sci-fi western, but it's really not. It's more about a commentary about voyeuristic entertainment culture.
Mm-hmm.
Right? You know, and what the media and government, etc., do to perpetuate that, to keep masses entertained.
Right. It's very Truman Show, Doctor Who-esque.
Yeah. V for Vendetta, all this kind of stuff kind of touches on that.
Yep.
It's just a matter of what you wrap it in. And I think the whole sci-fi aspect of this really kind of extra appealed to me.
Sure.
Like, I love that kind of, like, high concept sci-fi fantasy.
Right.
Especially with characters that are kind of funny, good foils, and good reveal. So in that respect, it's formulaic in how it's executed. The characters are really good, but then the hook and the twist are more of the literary and social commentary.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, so I don't know if we have any... I don't know how far we can get into that without, like, analyzing the whole book piece by piece, but it's really... If you're looking for something that's more than just a action, adventure, sci-fi, which you can read it that way too, but I don't think it holds up strictly as that.
I don't think it does at all. I think that if you remove the, like, the power component of, like, the role that the corporation, government entity, that as the pusher of the media, if you remove that, then, like, you lose the impact of the resolution in this particular issue.
Yeah, well, and if you remove the power, like, that sort of unwritten, you know, like, the unwritten sort of aspect of the power of the story, and someone finding that power, being able then to write the story, and how characters are eternal because they're part of the framework of reality in that way.
Right.
You know, that's really where it gets into the esoteric there.
Well, the meta with the iconic character and, like, literally walking off into the sunset, right? Like,
yep. Yeah.
That's kind of lovely, but I think it's lovely because it's given to us simultaneously with this commentary about the way that those characters are, like, the foils of those characters are presented via the corporation and the show.
Yep. And the military and everything, you know, kind of being intertwined. And I think we have this a lot as a discussion in a society about the power of the media and how it is so intertwined with politics and government and the military and everything else, especially post-Vietnam, you know, in the U.S.
Sure.
Here.
Sure.
It's something we talk about a lot, except it seems like we're still heading towards the inevitable. Well, as much as, like, society is aware of it, we don't seem to really care.
We're having the exact same conversations.
Yeah.
I mean, the same response to just war being shown as, you know, entertainment or edutainment in the kind of sick way that it is dealt with in the media. Exact same response now that we've had for the past 15 years, for the past 30 years. So I don't think that conversation, I agree with you that we're heading towards the inevitable, but, like... We're not doing anything to stop ourselves from doing that.
Yeah, well, it kind of makes me wonder, do people care?
I think you have to define very carefully what people care about. I think that there are some, like, really kind of scathing moments in this series with the viewers in terms of, like, demanding what they want to see and then the realization, especially in this issue, of what they have been watching. And that's a kind of yucky reflection of what we all do.
Yeah, I would say even more so. It's more that the people have a realization that they've been manipulated. Mm-hmm. It's not so much the content that they then have an issue with. It's that they've been duped.
Right, you know? They've been duped because they were willing to seek out that content.
Absolutely. I mean, they're willing participant. Like, we, the masses, are a willing participant in our own...
demise?
Yeah, subjugation. Subjugation, maybe, sure. is a better word.
Sure.
And I think that's really what it's kind of showing, because it's not like, oh, once the people realize, like, the war is a sham, like, it's like, we don't really care. We just don't want to be the butt of a ruse or a joke or a scam.
Right.
I think that's really what it comes down to. It's like, you know, we're all willing to go to war in Iraq, but if we find out the premise for that was a lie to us, then people are incredulous.
Okay. I mean, you're making some very sweeping generalizations once you transfer that to, like, real-world stuff, which I don't necessarily agree with, but I accept your analogy.
And I don't know if I believe that 100%. I'm just sort of thinking, like, some of the stuff that's happened in the real world that might be an impetus for, you know, this story.
Sure. And it's definitely an interesting examination of motivation behind using power in that way, because you have to be getting something out of it other than just, like, your jollies in subjugating a people, right? It's got to be, some other kind of lucrative, like, bonus by setting up a system like what we see in this.
Yeah, we'll go on forever. I really feel like it's almost like you have a reason at the beginning, and the longer things go on, the reasons they've started get forgotten.
Yeah, no, that's excellent.
And they just perpetuate.
That kind of moment when the people realize that it was a ruse, and, like, what do they do now? Like, they have been kind of empowered with that awareness, and so what is next?
Well, that's what always happens in these stories. It's like there's a triumph over the, you know, monolithic entity that's keeping you down. But right. Rarely do you get to explore what happens next, because realistically, it's chaos and destruction and the collapse of the system and marauding in the streets and, you know, death and destruction before a new society is built.
Mm. Chaos and destruction is a good segue to our next book, by the way.
Yeah, so maybe we should move on.
Myers, Shock, Silva here. In true Aaron Myers, the last thing I read or heard is the best thing ever! Style, I'll go with Bandette. Thanks to you two comic therapists, I recently read the very affordable hardcover that came out last month through Dark Horse. Somehow, having a hard copy makes this series even more enjoyable. Sorry, Shockster. Dinosaurs like me, digital haters gonna hate. I guess? Bandette is easily one of, if not the, best new female characters in comics. I will confess, I may be more of a fanboy of Bandette's rival, the Matador, but that's because she comes with a sword. If I'm going to go nostalgic and all drippy with feelings, it's Magic, Ileana Rasputin. Not in a creepy Aaron Myers male curiosity and a thick nod of heavy metal mags kind of way, but Magic was my first comic book crush. She had a bob haircut, a sword, again, sword, very important, and she was a demon sorceress. What's not to like? Magic pulled the New Mutants' asses out of the fire more than once, often using fire, and teleporting them out of trouble. That's what you want in a girl. I grew up Catholic. I was well acquainted with Satan and his works, and Magic was exactly the right temptation to lead me astray into comic bookery, which is a stupid word, bookery. Now I will say my adieus, and since you two never interact with these confessions like the two indifferent gods you are, all of this will seem like I'm talking to myself and shouting at a wall, like one does. Be good, you two crazy continuity wonks. Silva out.
Our second book is Quantum and Woody number 6, written by James Asmus, writ with art by Ming Doyle, coloring by Jordi Belair, and lettering by Dave Lanfear. It's published by Valiant Comics.
Okay, our story so far, and I'm just going to give you a really quick synopsis. Eric and Woody Henderson, foster brothers and total opposites, were reunited after years of estrangement by the death of their scientist father. Poking around in his lab, an accidental power surge caused by Woody imbued the brothers with fantastic energy. Now they shoot blasts and generate shields of pure power, but they're bound by metal wristbands that have to clang together every 24 hours, or they dissolve into atoms. The only other thing from the recap in this particular issue that you should be aware of is that Eric is working with the company Magnum Security, who is taking advantage of his powers and has sent him to be a private superhero on a suicide mission.
Did you ever read any Valiant comics like in the 90s?
Yeah, a handful. And actually a couple have just been more recently recommended to me. But so
The original ones?
I'm sorry?
Of the original ones?
No, like the current.
Yeah, yeah.
Uh-huh. Current things.
Yeah, it's been a really great relaunch for the company. But like Quantum and Woody and Archer and Armstrong were a couple of my favorites from those original ones.
Mm-hmm.
And it's because they were very funny, but still well executed.
Yeah.
You know, little worlds that were really kind of different than a lot of stuff in the 90s. You know,
yeah.
There's plenty of superhero stuff, and there was plenty of funny superhero stuff, but it wasn't. They were maybe tied to the DC or Marvel universe. So this was its own kind of contained universe that was really well done, especially for its time.
I'm not sure that I would have appreciated the humor then the way that I do now.
Yeah, maybe not.
I think I was, I don't know, too busy being angsty.
Uh-huh. Sure. Well, now you can go back, you know, now that your angst is a little more refined, you could go back and appreciate them.
Yeah, because I love this. It's a super fun book.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's got a lot of fun kind of tropes and things like the goat are, you know, that's an ongoing thing from the first series too, where it was kind of an ongoing joke, you know,
mm-hmm.
too, that would raise up. But that kind of stuff that you can get tied to in a story make it really entertaining, especially when it's not anchored to a bigger universe like a Marvel or DC.
Sure.
Like the Valiant universe has a lot of titles and it keeps growing, but it's its own self-contained thing.
Well, and there's obviously something inherently appealing about the odd couple combination.
Yeah.
Having one be very motivated by, like, money and...
Power
and girls. And just, like, he's really not a stellar example of humanity. And, like, Eric's kind of a really nice guy and tries really hard and wants to do good. And
but at the same time, that odd couple dynamic, what always makes it interesting is that they learn to find a middle ground with each other.
Sure.
And because they have to be around each other, they're forced to continue to grow.
Right. But the opposite natures are like the hook, obviously.
Yeah, and it runs throughout because they're opposite in their power. You know, they're split in the power and the mm-hmm. power has to come together in order for them to survive.
Mm-hmm.
And personality-wise and race-wise and everything, you know. It kind of permeates throughout everything.
Sure.
But I still like that you have to get to find a common ground with people you are not, you know, the opposite of. And to use that to overcome adversity.
Yeah, this was weird because they weren't working, you know, together as cohesively for a large section.
I think we've been circling around that back and forth, and every time they're split apart, they find out how much they need each other, too.
Right, right.
And that's really what it comes, you know, that's the growth of their relationship.
Yeah, I don't know. It sounds like you take this a little bit more seriously than I do, and I don't mean to put aside any of the commentary that you're providing. Like, you totally are right. They are growing, and that is a necessary thing with the two of them, and blah, blah, blah. But I think the lightness and like the irreverence is what is the consistent through line for this, as opposed to the growth. And like, that's
sure,
what I find.
Yeah. Oh, that's the entertainment value.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's very different from.
Definitely. The more intellectual stuff is going to be secondary because that's not as fun, Tim.
But it's still, it's like smart, funny.
Right.
It's very self-aware, and that's hard to do.
It's hard to do well without breaking down that fourth wall too much.
Exactly, exactly. And so there's a lot of stuff out there that tries and just, like, is kind of weak when it comes to that balance. And I guess maybe you're right. Like, the fourth wall acknowledgement is, like, kind of necessary for that self-awareness, but if you overuse that, then it turns into like another Deadpool knockoff, and
yes,
right. Nobody needs that.
Nope. I agree.
But it's a lot of fun, and I think that it's a lot of fun because it's like consistent without being predictable.
I think you're right, and it's early enough in this run that people could go and catch up really easily.
Oh yeah, absolutely. So you recommend going back and reading the other ones? Because I'll be honest, I didn't do that when I started reading this, and I think I started reading it when the second or third one came out.
Yeah, I wouldn't say go back to read the '90s one. I mean, you could probably find plenty of them in quarter bins, but you know, it's a fresh reboot from when they restarted these series. So yeah, just read it from the beginning for people. And it's fun if you're browsing at the local shop and you find a bunch of old Valiant stuff to pick them up, because they should be really cheap. And it's kind of neat to compare and contrast, just because they're still good.
I have a bunch of old Valiant stuff, but now brace yourself, because this is going to make your head explode. I have no idea what I have.
Oh, that doesn't surprise me at all.
Right, okay.
I've seen your stacks. It's soul-crushing.
I, too, am very consistent in that regard.
Yes.
But I know I don't have this, so I don't know. Maybe one of these days in my copious free time, I will actually... I'm sure cataloging what I have versus what most of you guys have is laughable. So it'll take me a day or two to sort through stuff, but whatever.
You want to talk about a book that's easy to get into?
Ah, yes. My favorite one of the week. That's why I put it last.
All right, let's talk about it.
Hi, Comics Therapy Podcast. This is Allison, a.k.a. The Gentle Nerd on Twitter. I hope I'm not too late with my nerd confession, but my favorite female comic book character is Wonder Woman. She's kind of had a great week, so I've been thinking about her a lot. And the reason that she is my favorite is that she is the representation of strength and compassion. And I love that she can show how a woman doesn't have to be super angry all the time or extra tough and hard-edged to have strength. She can also love and care about people. She's very complex. She can lift a tank and beat up a god, and then she also wants to take you out for coffee and ask you about your day. Wonder Woman is definitely who I aspire to be, and she's just the absolute best, y'all, really. So, thank you.
Hello, Andrea. Hello, Aaron. This is Joe Patrick from the Two-Headed Nerd Comic Book Podcast, calling in with my answer. I confess I struggled a little bit with this. In the past, I would have said that my favorite female character was She-Hulk, specifically Jennifer Walters. I really appreciated the fact that she was a character that was just as insecure as the rest of us. It just so happened that she could turn into a 7-foot-tall green goddess and, you know, fight through that. Kind of like Wonder Woman, but with more foibles, I suppose. But in recent years, I think that Marvel has really made a case for Carol Danvers, a.k.a. Captain Marvel. And I am really enjoying how they are building her up as a top-tier character, as not just a great female character, but a great character in general, somebody that is iconic in the Marvel Universe, and they're working really hard to elevate her to that status, and I really love it. I love what Kelly Sue has done with the character in her solo title. I love what Jonathan Hickman has done in his Avengers books, giving her some of the spotlight in Infinity. It's been a lot of fun watching her rise. And really, it's been a long time coming ever since Kurt Busiek brought her back to the forefront when he relaunched Avengers in the mid-90s. And so she's been on this really great character arc. I guess my answer is it's a toss-up. But they both come from Marvel, and so I think that means that other comic book companies have a long way to go in revitalizing and rejuvenating and building up their female character base. Great show, guys. Thanks for letting me call in. I'll talk to you soon. Bye-bye.
Our final book this week is Velvet No. 2, published by Image Comics. Velvet is written by Ed Brubaker, with art by Steve Epting. Elizabeth Brettweiser did the coloring, and Chris Eliopoulos did the lettering.
I don't want to recap this, because everybody just needs to read it.
Yeah, we're two issues in. It's
what's your problem? Just pick them up.
Right, it's female James Bond.
Ah, she's cooler than that.
Well, that's what I wanted to talk about.
Okay.
Because, yeah, she it is, but why?
Okay. So there's something very appealing about the fact that she had been working as the secretary, essentially.
Mm-hmm.
Secretary with privileges to the commanding officer in the unit and director, I don't know. The military breakdown of the organization is not something that I paid as much attention to as I probably should have, but there's clearly a hierarchy, and it's a fairly familiar secret agent setup, sure. So the fact that that's what she was to almost everybody, and yet that's not what she is or had been, is very cool.
Mm-hmm.
And her rediscovery of her capabilities, especially in this issue, and the acknowledgement of being out of practice, yet it's instinctive, is also really intriguing. And that's not a vulnerability that I ever associated with James Bond, although admittedly I am not a savant when it comes to Bond as a character.
Right, I mean, there's definitely Bond stuff where he's been out of the game and then is, pulled back into it kind of things, So it depends on which version of Bond you're looking at. There's the Bond who has a gadget for every situation and knows, he's the Batman of the spy world in a way.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's the vulnerable Bond who has to use his wits and sometimes luck and the people he knows in order to survive.
So, dare I say that the fact that Velvet is a woman makes that role more appealing to me? Because it's fuck you guys, look what I can do.
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, that's the hook. Otherwise, it's just another spy, action thriller.
Sure. I think it's greater than a hook, though. I mean, it's the essence of who she has been for so long.
I would say so, and it's a very hard way. It's very hard to portray a strong woman whose sexuality she's confident in her sexuality.
Mm-hmm.
Who is not at the same time falls into that power slut kind of category.
Tell me more about this power slut idea.
Oh, I think it's something that men will put onto women. I think it's sort of an amalgamation of what used to be slut shaming,
mm-hmm.
And then also, this woman's empowered and she takes control of it. There's a tendency now, I think, to acknowledge the power and sexuality of a woman and that she could be confident in it. At the same time, sort of having an edge of judgment too.
Oh, sure.
Where it's it's great, you're strong in your sexuality and confident in who you are, and you could do just what a man does, right? But there's the tone that really says nah, you're just another one of them. And
right.
I'm not saying this takes it. I think it's a hard thing to not fall into that trap.
Yeah, I don't think that this is anywhere close to that.
Whether the writer intends it or not, even if the writer obviously doesn't intend it, I think to convince other people not to let their mind fall in that way is a feat too. If that makes sense?
Yeah, absolutely. But I think part of that is avoided by being privy to her descriptions of the way that she has used her sexuality.
Uh-huh.
So we are aware of how she views her role with some of these agents, and also like why some of them are more dear to her than others. And so she's allowed to be human. Like, she's allowed to fuck around just for the fun of it. And yet she's also allowed to still have feelings and like have a closeness and like a camaraderie with some of these men. So it's not, she's not just a robot using her sexuality. She's not just a robot, like running from her past.
Yes.
So right. I think that that is a very unique combination, and it's very appealing to read and like follow along with.
Yeah, I'm totally hooked after two issues. That's why I think you know, it's premature for us to really get into too much of the story because we just don't have it yet. But I thought it would be fun to talk about this initially, like what are our initial feelings, and then maybe revisit it, you know, after two arcs or something.
I do want to acknowledge that I guess maybe we have been acknowledging. I just want to like hit everybody in the head with a hammer about this, that the reason why it's so striking is because it's rare, right? Like, this character combination in a woman doesn't happen very often in not just comics, but like in stories in general.
Yeah, I agree. I hope we get more from her perspective and less from others as we go on, though. As we get to know her more, we get more into her thoughts. Because right now in these first two issues, she's kind of running. She's running and not having time for reflection.
See, I don't necessarily agree. And I know that when we talked to Alex earlier this week, that was her impression after the first issue. But now having read the second issue and kind of keeping that in mind, because we talked to Alex before I had read the second issue and I was conscious of that.
Uh-huh.
I actually welcome the inner monologue coupled with getting some insight about how everybody else feels about her, especially the fact that most of the men didn't know what she was capable of. And so I think that that is an incredibly valuable balance to like see the roles that she has been portraying and like the personas that she is a master of, and then also getting some like a view into how she's feeling about it.
Okay, I can accept that.
Thank
yeah,
you.
I maybe what I'm feeling too is like we don't know her well enough yet because it's only been two
but
issues.
I think we're very set up to become like BFFs with her as the story continues.
Yeah, I'm excited to explore it. Do you want to talk about and talk to Alex DeCampi?
Right. Beautiful segue.
Super smooth.
Yeah. Excellent commentary on lots of stuff with Alex, so I hope you guys enjoy.
Hi, Aaron. Hi, Andrea. It's Jason Sachs from Comics Bulletin, at Jason Sachs or at Comics Bulletin on the Twitter. I'm sure you're going to be getting a lot of different answers to your question of the week about who's your favorite female character. I have to go a little off the board, I think, from what most people will be talking about. My favorite female character, and one that I've loved in comics since she first appeared, is Hopi from Love and Rockets. There's just this unbeatable, amazing spirit to this woman. She's been through hell. She's been back from hell. She's had all kinds of amazing, bizarre, interesting adventures. Has finally settled down into something vaguely resembling a normal middle-class life. And I just think that she's awesome, interesting, fun character who I've been enjoying growing up with all these years. She's just a full-fledged, fully interesting, complex character that I love to spend time with. Thanks. Great question this week. Bye.
My favorite female comic character is one that hasn't been invented yet, but she is a glimmer in her creator's heart and mind right now. One of 1,000 new, astonishing female characters created by a wave of people who dream of making the best comics they can, inspired by the world outside their window. Characters without worry about backlash or being judged by Democratic placeholders or politically correct replacements created in a new era when only the character matters. She is going to be mighty and human, full of life, and will blow me away, and then there will be 100 more.
We're very excited to welcome Alex DeCampi to the couch this week. Alex is a writer and director known best for her Eisner-nominated series Smoke and the 2011 follow-up Ashes. She is currently writing Grindhouse for Dark Horse, and her comic Valentine is now being re-released digitally on every Wednesday on Thrillbent.com. Thanks for joining us, Alex.
Good. Thank you for having me.
So Grindhouse number 3 is out this week. We have questions about that in a bit. But first, just for context, are there other things you want to mention that Aaron didn't list, just to give us a sense of what else you have going on, upcoming comics or one-shots or even non-comics projects that we should be aware of?
Gosh, the only thing I have that's actually, you know, all set with a publisher and ready to come out is I've got the number one of the new My Little Pony series was written by myself and Carla Speed McNeil and drawn by Carla and is coming out in January.
Oh, excellent.
We had a lot of fun with that. We're both moms, and so we essentially did it for our kids. And it's full of humor that a three-year-old would appreciate, because my daughter's 3. So
that's awesome.
It was a lot of fun. Other stuff, gosh, there's so much that's up in the air. Jerry Ordway and I have a horror series that's coming out in Dark Horse Presents, but it hasn't been scheduled yet.
Oh, wow.
Ramon Perez and I are doing a noir graphic novel, which is written, but we're not ready to pitch yet. We're still getting ready the pitch drawings and stuff.
Uh-huh.
I've got other graphic novels that are just sort of in holding patterns while I look for artists and I seem to find myself writing a novel, which was somewhat accidental. It was a sci-fi futuristic idea that just rapidly became more than could be fit in a comic. Before you rang me up, I was doing research on it.
Is that the first time that you've really pushed more, I guess, heavily into prose?
I have in the past, but nothing that I was really happy with. I may not be happy with this. It may never come out. I may never finish it. You don't know.
Can you talk us through a typical writing day? We do ask this a lot, but in your case, one of the things I wanted you to address is how you manage writing with family life. We talk so much with creators about work-life balance, and no offense, but you guys all seem kind of lousy at it. But Aaron and I know from our individual experiences that when you add kids to the mix, it makes everything just absolutely crazy. So how do you do that, and how do you strive for that balance?
Shush. That would be Duke. That's my foster dog. I stopped petting him. He says hi. It's very difficult. I also don't make enough via writing to survive, so I also have a part-time job. So I'm working all the time, basically. My daughter goes to daycare 4 days a week. I work at the part-time job somewhere between 2 and 4 days a week, usually every Saturday. And my mom looks after my daughter. I'm a single mom. So on days when I'm not working the part-time job and my daughter is at daycare, those are my working days, my writing days. And I usually, I take her into daycare, come back, do all the dishes, make coffee, make a bagel, and then sit down to write at 9. I try not to go on the internet before that. I start my writing time because it just distracts me.
Mm-hmm.
I'm usually pretty successful at that. And then I'll write from 9 to, 11, 12, depending. Take the dogs out for a walk. And then in the afternoon, I'll do all the other stuff that's associated with a creative career, like marketing, emailing, lettering. I do a lot of my own lettering. It's now part of my process for working on comic books.
Oh, wow.
And I do that in the afternoons because it's also nice because by then my brain's pretty shot anyway, and I can listen to a podcast or music or something like that while I letter. Because when I write in silence. It's easier that way.
Uh-huh.
I can concentrate better.
Do you mean that the lettering is actually part of like your editing or kind of like your final pass, that you're doing it as a writer as well as?
Yes.
Like, how does it? Okay. That's awesome. I actually haven't heard of somebody kind of being so organic with their writing process that it's so like fluid into the actual like production process as well.
Well, that's what Grant Morrison does. He doesn't even write dialogue. I mean, I'm more specific than that. I actually write like Grant Morrison will hand a script. I was talking to Yannick Paquette, who's drawing Wonder Woman with him. And Grant just hands off like panels with story, but no dialogue. And then Yannick draws it. And then when it comes back to Grant, he'll then write the dialogue on top of it. And his panel descriptions are very vague. It's more about, you know, the experience to the user, to the reader than it is like, you know, draw this, draw that. I'm very different from that. I write a very specific script. Sometimes too specific. For Ramon, he's asked me to write it as scene breakdowns, which was fun to do and very different, but I trust him. I tend to start off very specific. Even when I'm doing something like scene breakdowns, I know exactly what's going on in my head and like what angle the camera is and yada yada. And then it's drawn. And then once I've written this incredibly specific strip, I hand it off to the artist and I sort of say, do what you want with it. If you want to like combine panels or delete or move things around, please feel free to do so. You can ignore as much of this as you want. I do generally specify that you don't ignore the spirit of the page, like the storytelling point. You know, if it's supposed to be a dramatic cliffhanger and it's drawn as a sort of very blah moment, then that's a problem for me. But if it's a dramatic cliffhanger that I've written in 6 panels and they can do it in 2, fine. You know, if they've got a better idea, fine.
And does that allow you, when you go through the lettering process, then to tighten up the dialogue and kind of redo the script?
Yes. I don't do a ton, but I tend to shorten up dialogue. Things get moved between panels a lot. I add in sound effects to the art just to emphasize certain things or create more of an atmosphere. And I find that's much easier to do once I've already seen the art rather than writing sound effects ahead of time. And then I just make sure it's as tight as possible.
I have a question kind of about where things came from. So you write political thrillers, war stories, Death by Acid. You claim to love explosions. So what kind of books and movies did you read and watch as a kid that influenced the kind of writing you do now?
Books, I read every bad sci-fi and fantasy novel with like a shiny metallic like title that you could possibly find. If you go to the British blog Good Show, Sir, it lists really bad sci-fi and fantasy covers from the 70s and 80s. And I love looking at it because I'm like, yep, read that. Yep, oh, Piers Anthony, I read everything by him. Oh, yep, read that. It's basically like my old book collection. And they're like, lol, funny book cover. And I'm like, hey, I really like that book. I also, but as I got more seriously into things, I read a ton of literature. I'm very influenced by poetry, modern poetry, people like John Ashbery, John Berryman. I think in an economy of language and subtext and symbolism, that comes from my love of poetry. Mm-hmm. And I've seen, you know, I was kind of a latchkey kid, so I watched a ton of TV, and I usually watched just whatever was on the old Channel 29 outside Philadelphia, which is now part of Fox, but it just used to be the local TV channel and would broadcast old movies. So I've seen like Cleopatra Jones like 8 times. Just every time it came on, I'd watch it, and because movies would be on fairly heavy rotation once they'd gotten them for a few months. You know, all sorts of old, you know, like Guns of Navarone and Where Eagles Dare, and like all sorts of old like war films, any spy film that they could possibly show. So I think, you know, there aren't, you know, if you grow up loving movies in the 70s and 80s, there wasn't a lot like specifically for girls. And so I grew up watching like war films and Sam Peckinpah stuff, and was like, this is great.
What about comics exposure? Did you have any growing up? Like, was that acceptable?
X-Men. I was a big X-Men fan. I think X-Men are always like, I thought a lot about why X-Men work for kids and girls especially. And it's because it's basically a giant soap opera. I mean, it's more about the interdynamics of the team than it is necessarily about the bad guys. so it's, you know, if you're in junior high or high school, like, the, you know, these people are all behaving terribly to each other, and it's very reminiscent of, like, you know, your, what's going on in your own life at the time.
Yeah, and especially if it was, like, what, late 70s through the 80s, that would have been kind of the heyday of Claremont, which was...
Yeah, Punk Storm, she was my girl, you know, Kitty Pryde and her dragon and her awesome Russian boyfriend.
Right.
Like, she had a pet dragon. Like, this is made of wind.
And it's high, and it's high drama. It's all the interplay between these characters. They're constantly fighting with each other, heartbreak and loss, and...
Yeah, and the whole, like, you know, Logan... Cyclops, Jean Grey love triangle, which they've been milking for 30 years and are still milking. You know, there's nothing comparable. And I think part of it is also that the female heroes are, you know, they're not girlfriends. Like, for Spider-Man, there's Spider-Man and then his girlfriends.
Right.
Like, yes, who are just like random girls and they're always getting kidnapped. And Lois Lane, who's there to get kidnapped. And Batman doesn't really have girlfriends. Batman had Robin.
Well, he has Talia.
Yeah, but not back then. Talia was kind of is a more recent thing.
Mm-hmm.
So not only is there this great dramatic interplay between these people who act like teenagers, you know, there are women who are equal to the men and are also heroes in their own right, whereas in a lot of the other comics, the women were, you know, sort of somehow like secondary.
Yeah. Always the object of rescue or peril.
Yeah, which is dull after a while. I mean, you know, male readers don't necessarily notice it because you only notice things that look like yourself, really. We're all like that.
Yeah.
But after a while, as a woman, you're like, really?
Well, this is jumping ahead a little bit, but how do you feel about the state now in general when it comes to how the comics industry portrays women? Do you think that there are enough advances and variety of storylines that kids now and those junior high girls now who are reading comics can find more examples beyond just X-Men?
Nope.
You want to talk about that?
Well, no, I think there aren't. I mean, weirdly, I think we're in a golden age of comics right now. I think we have some of the best comics coming out that we've had in a really, really long time. Almost all of those are independent books. Mm-hmm. And almost all of those are not aimed at a young teen audience or are not suitable for a young teen audience. I mean, I love the shit out of Lazarus, but like, would I give it to a 10 to 12 year old? Maybe not.
Absolutely not.
you're like, absolutely not. I'm like, maybe not. you know, Velvet, which you're going to go into later, which was a really interesting issue one for me, because it almost felt like a bait and switch between the trailer and the actual books. Like, suddenly it was all from a male perspective, and I was like, what? You know, the beginning of it was like this guy telling the story, and I'm like, no. Uh-huh. I want to hear from Velvet. Like, see, even Duke wants to hear from Velvet. And then it got better by the end, but I liked it, but it was interesting what I expected to get from the trailer and what the number one actually was. And they felt very, very different to me.
Mm-hmm.
But again, not a book for, you know, a 10 to 12 year old would be just bored silly by that book. Cause of, you know, it's a slow burn 70s style spy thriller. I can't think of, admittedly, I don't read a lot of mainstream books because I pick one up and it's kind of like, oh, really? And then I put it down again and it makes me sad. And I think, oh, I just wasted $4. And then I'm not likely to buy another one. And there's so many, they confuse me. So I could be very wrong about the state of books for a young teen audience, but I just don't think there are a lot of books that would appeal to younger girls. I don't think the solution is bringing out books specifically targeted at younger girls, because the industry tried that for a while. I mean, do you remember the Aunt May, it's like summer camp thing that Mark Miller wrote, had the photoreal covers, and it was just like a whole pile of cringe. just Google, like, if you don't know what I'm talking about, gentle listener, go Google Mark Miller trouble and image search it. And this was this Aunt May at summer camp thing. And look at the cover. And it's just like, ah, just so, so much cringe.
I have not seen that, but that sounds like an amazingly disastrous pairing up of character and creator.
And cover. It's the cover. The cover is just like, it makes you feel like a, like Pedo Bear, basically, if you pick it up.
I think it was actually Adam who sent me a picture of that cover.
Adam and I were talking about it, I think, in the pub at one point when I was in New York. I've had a lot of fun sitting down. Like, every so often, like, Adam, Dan Goldman, and I go to a pub and just eviscerate, say all the things we can't say online about comics. But yeah, that, and, you know, Runaway, I think Runaways is a good example, the old Brian Vaughn book, one of the books that actually brought him to, you know, started him on his very swift and well-deserved upward career. You know, Saga, another book, like, not for, you know, not for 10 to 12 year olds. It's just like, no, giant ball sack, no.
Right.
But
that's the image that you're pulling out as being inappropriate.
of the many images in there that are inappropriate. I mean, you know, that's a book I would have loved at that age, but I thought if my parents had caught me with it and opened it, I would have gotten in trouble.
Exactly.
Yeah, I think Runaways was a great example. That was a book not targeted, I don't believe targeted at young girls. It was targeted just at young readers. Mm-hmm. And I think that's the secret, is when you start, when the comic book industry starts trying to make, you know, 10 or 11 year old girls go into a comic book shop and buy, you know, pamphlet comics like 32 pagers, which are actually 22 to 24 pages plus ads.
Mm-hmm.
That's where it fails. Where when you just write a really good story that can appeal to both girls and boys, you just get a bleed effect. Like, the girls discover it kind of by osmosis, and then the book sells a lot. Whereas if you just are targeting at girls, it doesn't sell. And then they're like, oh, well, we're never going to market to girls again. Like, oh, we tried a young teen book, you know, oh, we tried a black character, oh, we tried this and nobody bought it, you know, not really taking into account that, like, they may have done just a really, really shitty job at it. And the reason no one bought it was because it was shit, not because, like, that audience feel like doesn't want comics.
Right.
Well, that kind of makes me wonder, like, what's your feelings, both mainstream and independent, on the state of female creators in the industry? Like, as a female creator, are we making progress? Are women getting more drawn to comics? Is it an open market for them, or are there still, you know, is there still a ceiling? Is there a barrier to entry?
Well, again, I think people default to hanging out with other people who look like them. Mm-hmm. And hiring people who look like them. It's not necessarily a conscious decision. I mean, I'm sure there are some, like, in fact, yes, I know, I could name names, but I won't. Some specifically, you know, truly misogynistic people and or racist people at various comic book companies and homophobic people. You know, in every business, in every company, there's going to be that asshole. Mm-hmm. It's not specific to comics. If you get 100 people together, the bell curve says that 10 of them are basically going to be subhuman tools. and 10 of them are going to be amazing human beings. I think it has gotten tremendously better. I mean, we've got Marjorie Liu, we've got Kelly Sue, you know, Amy Reeder, Ming Doyle. We've got a lot of women just really knocking it out of the park right now. It's still, you know, less than 5% of the people that are writing mainstream comics have a vagina. So we're like really celebrating how well we're doing, but in the great scheme of things, we're still really, really behind.
Mm-hmm.
You know, also it's a lifestyle thing. Like, you know, young 22-year-old guys who really, really, really want to write Batman and, like, that's their dream, they're going to go to every convention and, like, bombard editors and stuff like that. You know, I'm 40 and I have a 3-year-old kid, and I'm it in terms of parents. I go to maybe 2 conventions a year.
Yeah.
So I'm also, you know, not necessarily out there the way the super motivated people are to try to get the work from those specific people and specific editors.
So it's almost a societal barriers in some ways too.
Partially for some people, not necessarily everyone. I mean, you know, there are probably 25-year-old girls who are just going to every convention and hassling the editors too. So,
Yeah, that's what I wonder, if it's like we're kind of in this in-between time generationally, where, you know, the next crop of people who are going to be writing comics are just getting kind of to the age where they're out of college. And it's maybe it is a more even mix of men and women. That's why I'm always kind of look, you know, you can only kind of look to what social media and kind of you get kind of cursorily, you know, as people are interested. But it seems like there are a lot of more women interested in comics than there were in the past. I'm just wondering if that translates to creation too.
I believe it does. It doesn't translate to creation as quickly at DC and Marvel. If that's what you mean by mainstream, I think at some point we need to stop talking about them as the mainstream, because there is so much more out there and they're such a smaller part of the market than they used to be. And the nexus of power has shifted and diffused greatly. Outside of DC and Marvel, yes, there are a ton of female creators. There's a ton of interesting stuff going on. We're all already there. I think we're probably somewhere near parity. I mean, Heidi McDonald would probably know better than me, because she keeps track of these things with actual numbers as opposed to just gut sense. But, you know, on the independent side, yeah, I'd say it's already happened.
Well, let me ask you about just personal life and non-comics time. Like, what kind of things do you read and watch now? Like, what's your guilty pleasures? What's your decompression? Do you decompress at all?
A lot of my decompression involves reading Dr. Seuss to my daughter.
And that totally counts.
Watching movies with her, watching My Little Pony. I really miss seeing movies on my own, though. I mean, I really want to go see Hunger Games: Catching Fire, because I enjoyed the heck out of the first one. I really want to see the Thor movie, but that would mean me essentially bunking off my writing time to go to the cinema, which I'd love to do. And I just can't, because I'm behind on stuff. I need to get more work out there. I have a book to letter before December 15th. And it's spending money, which I don't do. You know, I try to catch movies where I can. I randomly feel like having a John Cassavetes film marathon at some point. So I have the Criterion 5 set of his films, and I'm going to sit there and watch some for the first time and rewatch others. I have the new Takashi Miike film. I love him. He's kind of one of my favorite directors. The teacher one. And I want to watch that. That's definitely not something I can watch with my daughter. And novels, again, I've literally been so cripplingly poor. I can't, you know, my daughter needs winter boots, so I don't buy books. So I haven't, like, the last book I read was Alexander Irvine's The Narrows. We did a book swap when we were at Coast City Comic Con, and I gave him some of my books and he gave me some of his. How broke people read. And I've got to go to the library and get some stuff out, because I miss having a book to read at night. The Narrows is great. You should read it. I can understand why it didn't sell a ton, because it's this really interesting mix of a more literary novel and a supernatural thriller. And all the supernatural thriller people would have been like, where's the sex? Where's the cliffhangers? And all the literary people are like, what? This has weird supernatural elements. but it's a really, really great novel. So yeah, Alex Irvine, The Narrows, go find it, read it. He's pretty awesome. And his prose is really good. I mean, I'm a bit of a prose stylist. So if people's prose is really blah, and is just like thundering ahead just to tell the story, it makes me sad and I don't want to read the book. There has to be some sort of elegance and rhythm to the prose. Otherwise, count me out. And his has that. I wish I could do more. I kind of feel like I need a vacation, and I just want to, you know, just want to go get a book and not have to think about whether I can afford it.
Is there a style or a genre that you haven't played around with as a creator that is still one of your favorites to read or to watch?
In some senses, Carla was talking to me the other day. She's like, you've never written a love story. And I'm like, no, I haven't. Not really. I mean, not a proper love story. I've written about sort of isolation and unrequited love and weird, like, relationships between people, but not a full-on love story. I'd sort of like to do that at some point within the context of something else. I don't want to just write a romance story.
But is that something that you appreciate when you read it or you watch it? Like, you would seek out a movie because it has a love story?
To some extent. I wouldn't, the films that are love stories are usually so badly done. I don't like a lot of films aimed at women, so I don't go and see them. I'm trying to think of, like, what a great cinematic love story. My sort of great cinematic love story moments, the two things that immediately pop to mind are Le Samurai, and which is sort of a strange love story, and Fernando de Leo's Milan 9mm, which is another strange one. there's noir stories, like noir love stories, you know.
It's a totally different kind of formula than the standard kind of quote unquote love story.
Right.
Yeah. I hate the kind of waiting for Prince Charming story.
Uh-huh.
Right.
The best remark I ever heard about that was, I got so tired of waiting for Prince Charming, I became him.
Oh, that's lovely.
That's the story I kind of want to write.
Well, as far as like all ages, like comics, that kind of brings, makes me think of Princeless. Have you seen that at all?
No, I haven't.
Which is sort of about that, like, the princesses get tired of waiting for their Prince Charming to come save them, so they save themselves.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's a great one for your daughter pretty soon. Maybe not quite yet, but very soon. It's a wonderful one for younger girls, especially.
Yeah. That's why I like Tangled a lot. Tangled was a lot of fun.
Yeah.
More than it should have been in some ways. More than I expected it would be. I think the one of the genres I haven't really tackled yet, although it's hard to say because I love Westerns. I write a lot about isolation anyway. And so the Western, which is, as I've said elsewhere, a genre that's obsessed with its own obsolescence. in every Western, it's about a way of life that is, the film is about the passing of a way of life, always. Ultimately, always, it's about, the ranch is being taken over for development. There's going to put a railroad through there. It's all like life is changing. This kind of rural, this hard-scrabble rural idyll is being interrupted and changed somehow by money.
And the hero is the kind of the last of a dying breed.
Yeah. And temporarily hitting the reset button, essentially.
Yeah.
And I don't know, there's something that really speaks to me about Westerns. I suppose because another of the genres I really love, which is the spy thriller, is another genre that is essentially facing obsolescence because of technology.
Mm.
The man with the gun finding out the secrets. When you can sit in a computer room in a bunker under the Pentagon and hack into Chinese mainframes, why do you need the man with the Walther PPK?
Yeah.
I'm really fascinated by the kind of mix of spy thriller and Western. In some ways, that's what Ashes, both Smoke and Ashes, were about. They were strange Westerns, almost more than they were spy thrillers. But I'd love to write a more straight up Western at some point. In some ways, the series that I've got in the works with Carla is about that. But it's not a traditional Western in any way.
Well, so you're a filmmaker as well as a writer. You've directed music videos for Amanda Palmer and Grand Duchy, Candlelight Red, among others. I want to talk about the filmmaking part, but I want to talk about music first. Are you also a musician? It seems like music is an important part of your creative process.
Music used to be far more important to me than it is now, weirdly. Music and its subcultures were a tremendously important part of my teenage years and self-identity into my 20s. And then at some point, like in the last 5 years, I've just stopped. I mean, I was never musical as a person. I can't sit. You never want to hear me sing. I will never be drunk enough that I will sing to you. I don't do karaoke. I can't play instruments. I have no musical ability whatsoever. I enjoyed listening to it. In some ways it was directing music videos that kind of made me less interested in music.
Oh no.
There's a point after you've listened to like 20-year-old rock bands talk about the importance of their music when you're just like, oh, kill me now. Whereas when you were much younger, you would have been like, oh my God, that's so meaningful. And I think music is one of the most important ways we express ourselves and express our feelings. One of the film critics I really like, Mark Kermode, who is a British film critic and has a program, a weekly program on Fridays on BBC Five Live, was talking about teen films. And he's actually a big, he loves Twilight. He loves the Hunger Games series. And he understands why they're important and why they're by and large successful films, both artistically and commercially, with some reservations for a couple of the missteps in Twilight. Even though David Cronenberg really should have directed the final installment. But he was talking about a book made into a film called Beautiful Creatures, which is almost an inversion of the Twilight dynamic, where it's about a girl who turns out to be part of a line of witches, of like witches and wizards, and they're in like rural Georgia or something. And it's interesting because in it, the woman is the teenage girl is portrayed as the great unknowable, and you never know whether she's good or bad or how interested in him she is. And the hero is a guy. And it's a really fun film. It's got some good product design, set design. Jeremy Irons chews every piece of furniture he comes across. We love Jeremy Irons. But it fell on its face. And the reason I think it fell on its face is young men are not going to go see a film about the great female unknowable in the way that girls will go see a film about like the great unknowable that are men, you know, they're boys, which is, this is like all that happens in your teenage years is you're trying to figure out what's going on with the opposite sex and how unknowable they are. And that's like, it is why these films are important and why they're successful, but not when you gender swap them, strangely. I'm not saying this is a completely hard and fast rule, but you can't just take the elements that made this genre of films incredibly successful with a teen female audience, gender swap them, and expect them to be successful with a teen male audience. And that got me to thinking about how, you know, teenage boys work through the great unknowable that is the opposite sex or the same sex if they're gay. You know, the great unknowable is the other that they are in love with, whatever tackle that other comes with. It's through pop songs. It's through music, you know, singing along to songs about love and about women and about heartbreak. You know, that's how teenage boys express themselves.
That's interesting because that is a much more isolated experience in most cases. You know, you're sitting at home and you're listening to music as opposed to this kind of shared bonding experience in a movie theater with your other girlfriends talking about the men that you're seeing on screen or the young men that you're seeing on screen that like I remember as a teenage girl.
Yeah, and talking about your feelings.
Right. Right. As opposed to sitting at home and listening to other people sing about your feelings. Thanks, guys.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm sure there are exceptions, but at least from my experience, that's definitely how it was for me. You didn't want to sit around with your guy friends and talk about like your feelings. You wanted to play, I don't know, D&D and light off, video games and that sort of thing.
Or whatever, the feelings
part of like male interaction, especially as a teenager, and of course this is my own experience, but really kind of came in cursorily. Like you would broach the subject sort of from the side and very fleetingly, without looking at each other while you're playing PlayStation 1 or something.
Right.
I had one of my best friends, was my flatmate in London for a long time. I could always tell when like something, like he was having a bad day or something, and we'd just be like, okay, let's go to the pub. And there was a pub like 50 yards from our front door. We had the best flat ever. literally like walk out our door, walk up the hill until you walk into a pub. Done. And then, you know, sort of after about four beers, he'd be like, yeah. And he'd tell me, like, he'd briefly mention what was going on. And I'd be like, man, that sucked. We'd have another round and everything would be okay. You know, that was how we discussed things. So yeah, I understand that as a way of coping.
Right. Well, so back to directing. Can you talk a little bit about how directing, any sort of narrative story is different from writing for a two-dimensional medium? Because in both cases, you are the gatekeeper for how that narrative is communicated visually by the artists. But mm-hmm. for your process, how do you separate those two approaches?
Directing, you are limited by budget. So you often have to find ways around things. I couldn't blow up the world. I couldn't have a car chase, you know, if I wanted to. The process for me for directing is often just, you know, especially music videos, you have a song. You're limited not only by budget, but by the song's dynamics and length. Mm-hmm. I mean, if you're thinking of something to happen during the middle eight, it happens during the middle eight, and it's as long as like the bridges, and that's it.
Right.
So you're creating a story to a preset soundtrack, essentially, which is great fun. I mean, it's similar to writing poetry in a specific format, you know, like sometimes a structure and limitations force you to do things that are much more interesting than if you had all the freedom in the world.
Sure.
I haven't done a lot of, you know, non-music video, non-commercial work. I was always doing so many low-budget music videos, I never got around to making a low-budget film of my own, which was stupid. But I was given, often I was making videos for people who were friends, so they were giving me a great deal of artistic freedom that I wouldn't have had if I were working for some much bigger artist who was paying me money instead of in hugs. But yeah, I mean, I would generally storyboard my ideas if it was properly narrative. If it had a performance element, I wouldn't storyboard it except for key shots. Mm-hmm. And it made me think, you know, a lot more about camera angles and pacing.
Yeah, I was going to ask if that was related to the way that you approach your writing now.
Yes, and I do annoy some artists because I will suggest camera angles and shot sizes. I'm just like, look, this is the way I work. You can ignore it. I'm going to, close up over the shoulder to blah. And I'll often say why. I want to emphasize the geographic proximity. You know, I think the discipline of directing, if done properly, if you understand what, like why you're choosing various shots, like what each shot brings to the table in terms of what it's telling the viewer and what it's suggesting to the viewer, simply in terms of shot size, in terms of angle, in terms of who's included, whether it's a shoulder, whether it's clean, what camera movement does and what continuing a shot does, like a tracking shot or something, or, mm-hmm. or a big jib move. It brings a lot in terms of your visual storytelling ability. Obviously, you know, you don't necessarily need that to make great comics. I know plenty of writers who don't care or have the faintest clue or think that's the artist's prerogative. And they're totally, you know, in many ways, they're totally right. Mm-hmm. Which is why when I put it in a script as a suggestion, I hate when people are like, you know, splash page, like the crowd of dinosaurs, have fun with this. Cause I feel like that's being really shitty to the artist. Cause like drawing a crowd scene is never fun. And you know, like the artist is drawing little voodoo dolls of you in the margins and taking their dip pen with the oldest nib and like stabbing it through the heart repeatedly as like, you know, you're like, you know, crowd scene, Gothic cathedral from a high angle. And in the center, there's a unicorn climbing up a spiral staircase. Die, 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 die. Have fun with it.
Motherfucker.
I think it's much better if you have, you know, because, you know, sometimes an artist goes to the page and they're really tired and they've had a shitty day and they're just like, tell me what to do. I'm going to draw what's on the script. And some days they're super motivated and they're like, hey, no, that would be much better if we do it this way. Like, you know, it's like you and I, like we all have good days and bad days. And sometimes mm-hmm. we just want a safety net to fall down on. So I'm going to give the artist that safety net. Whereas if they're just having a day where they're just like, oh, I'm just going to draw what the script says because, oh, I like, it's just been the worst day and I really don't want to be here and blah, and I'm not being paid enough. And so blah, there you go. They're going to be able to do that. And they're not going to have to guess or be told to have fun with it or whatever. But then if they want to innovate, like I've told them that they're totally free to do that and ignore everything I've written as long as they stick to the spirit of the story.
Well, that kind of leads me into my next question, because I was curious, you know, after you released Ashes, or when you released Ashes, it was a very successful mm-hmm. Kickstarter, but there was a lot of controversy around it. I don't really want to rehash or go into that. There's plenty of that, you know, people can look that up. But it really makes me, it made me wonder your thoughts on kind of finding that compromise of artistic vision versus the reality of bringing a book to print.
I'll compromise pretty far. I mean, that was a unique case. And when I said that, like, when people were going specifically against the story idea, like when a cliffhanger moment was drawn as a non-cliffhanger moment, and then I was like, well, this is the end of a chapter, like it's supposed to be a cliffhanger, there needs to be more tension, and you know, can we go back to how it was written? And then also when there was an issue with we got a big gig related to the Kickstarter that would have given us a ton of publicity and was super well paid. And the artist started throwing attitude towards the art editor of the magazine as well. I'm like, this is like a real problem. Like basically, as long as I feel like we're in it together and we're working towards the best possible solution, I don't give a shit if it's my solution. It's kind of awesome when it's my solution. When someone mm-hmm. comes along and goes like, here's a much, like, I'm going to take what you've written and make it much more awesome. That's great. And like, I try to give people as much freedom to do that as possible, because if I had a monopoly on solutions, I would be living in the Bahamas in fucking like Bond villain mansion with a cosmic right. death ray. And you'd all be sorry.
And I guess it's good for us all that you don't have all the solutions.
Yes. Certain people specifically.
So in your case, the artistic compromise is like, it's a shared, like,
it's shared like a ownership. Team. Yeah. It's a team thing. It's not like I'm having to climb down from like the right to allow someone else to do something. That's bullshit. I've put out an idea. Someone else has picked it up and taken it a few steps further, and it's changed in that. Like, it's like whatever you do, like, it's never going to be exactly as you see it in your head. Not when you direct, you know, even Stanley Kubrick and his like 200 takes. Like, Stanley Kubrick, like, man, not good mm-hmm. at compromising, you know, and it finally drove him nuts and he had to stop. It's a collaborative medium and you have to accept it as such. And that's the joy of it.
Yeah.
And character designs come back and they don't look like what's in your head. And you go, whoa. And then you look at it for a bit and you're like, that's actually better. I can do that. Or you have to say like, well, I love it, but can we change this a little bit? Can we change, you know, for this reason that happens later in the script, which I didn't tell you because I assumed you had mm-hmm. an ESP, like, she needs to be like this, or like, we need to have that, or she needs a bag or something. But you know, it's you have to have fun with it and you have to give a lot. Mm-hmm. It's not just taking, because then no one will want to work with you and everyone will be sad. And you'll be sad because you'll be like, why doesn't anyone want to work with me?
Well, let's talk about Grindhouse.
Let's talk about sex, baby.
Well, yeah, so Grindhouse, the book you're writing for Dark Horse, it's a genre that leans mm-hmm. heavily towards the exploitive when it comes to women. But your series is sexy and violent, but I don't feel like it crosses into that exploitive area. You know, was that, I'm assuming that was a conscious decision, but how did you approach this book?
Yep.
How did you achieve that?
It's a really delicate line to walk. And that's been the great fun and challenge of this book was, you know, I joke about something, something I sort of threw off when I was tired of writing like my big literary books and producing Ashes, which nearly killed me, and writing Margaret the Damned, which nearly killed me also and may never come out. I was like, hey, I'll write Bee Vixens from Mars. The internet was like, yes, you must do that. And then as I sat down with it, I'm like, I'm going to, you know, you can't write Grindhouse and write it halfway. Like, the horror and exploitation audience are really well educated. Like, the horror audience is, you know, in terms of filmmaking, they are one of the best educated in terms of their genre that you will ever come across. These people have often seen like hundreds of films and can, you know, and can school you on shit from like 1965 that like even Quentin Tarantino hasn't seen. and so you don't go halfway with them because they will see through you so fast, and they all talk to each other and it's a very supportive group, and then you will be dropped like a hot fucking rock. So if you're going to write Grindhouse, you have to make it super gory and super boobtastic because that's what that genre expects. So that was my first challenge, and like, how far can I push this? And the answer is, so far, Dark Horse, we're almost like, well, tone it down. and I'm like, point to where it crosses the R rating, and they couldn't. Like, point to the specific panel I have to change, and they couldn't point to it, which means I won. And then I wanted to make it not awful also, because one of the fun things about exploitation movies is you had things in the early 70s that you still don't have today, really. I mean, this year is a weird year to be saying that because we have both Gravity and the Hunger Games books, series, films, things, IP, product. Every time someone calls something IP, a fairy dies, by the way. which have strong female heroines. But that's incredibly rare for action films to have female, like a sole female lead.
Right.
You know, not a girlfriend or a tag along or someone that needs saving. And in the, you know, in the 70s, we had like all the blaxploitation films with these fantastic female heroines. We had, you know,
Fast. Yeah, I was going to say like the Russ Meyer films.
Yeah. Which, you know, Russ Meyer was apparently, according to some of the women who worked for him, just a misogynistic shitball. But, you know, what came out of that were films that like suddenly had all these like women with a tremendous amount of agency in their own fates. You go back to the, you know, the Japanese Pinky Violence films, the Girl Gang films, or the Female Prisoner Scorpion films. You know, a lot of the, you know, those films were starting to come over to America in the late 60s and 70s. You know, Lady Snowblood, one of the great vengeance films series ever. And so there's a lot to love in this genre for women. I mean, heck, there's The Adventure of Iron Pussy, which is like a trans super spy film from Thailand from, I think, it's actually this, I think it's like 2005, but it's really good. you know, convenience store clerk by day, like cross-dressing trans super spy by night, gets little like messages from the prime minister on the credit card receipts that come out of the machine and the like there's so much it's awesome about that film. it really is. And so that's what, yeah, that's why I love them. And I love a lot of the much darker giallo films, the Lucio Fulci and Dario Argento films. I love the Polizia Tesci, which are the like police noir Italian films that were coming over. All of that falls under exploitation. It's a tremendously wide genre. And like the batshit super futuristic stuff like Galaxina and Barbarella. There's so much crazy stuff going on, and so much of it is actually okay to women. Some of it really isn't, admittedly, but
it seems like you're a good steward for this in terms of writing, because you have both the knowledge base, but also, just the kind of love for it yourself. So,
yeah. And you have to be very politically aware when writing something like this. It's not, you know, unfortunately, a lot of like there are a lot of Grindhouse type series out there, and they're usually like sort of 5 or 6 issue image series and stuff. and they're generally written from the top of the privilege chain, which means like a white straight guy is writing it. And the girls are all hoes, and there's one black guy, and he's a drug dealer. And you're just like, and he's the bad guy. And you're just like, really? And, you know, people are writing what looks like them. And so I'm writing what looks like me. So I'm actually writing a lot of female characters in these stories. And, you know, very, very, very bad things happen to them. You know, I'm not saying they're all just like sailing through untouched. But it's not like hateful or misogynistic or homophobic or racist. At least I'm trying not. I'm not saying I've done it perfectly because, you know, who knows? It's up to the readers to decide. Right. But it's, you know, it's something that's going to make you feel good at the end of it. It's something that's going to make anyone, no matter what they look like and, you know, and what they want to stick their junk in or have stuck in their junk, like they're going to be okay with it. It's not, they're not going to open it up and be like, oh, this is really actually hateful towards me as a reader because it's insulting, like something that I identify with. I mean, it was weird because there was a mainstream book that I was actually sort of looking forward to that came out the same week as Grindhouse number one. And I picked it up and I'm like, oh, I'm going to love this series. And it was violently homophobic and misogynistic. And I was just like, damn, like it was really funny because all the things that people consider, like the uneducated consider about Grindhouse films, were actually in this mainstream comic book out from one of the big two publishers. And here was my like super gross, like, you know, girls touching themselves on page one, panel three, like gore fest. And it didn't have this like this hateful feel to it. You know, and I really do believe that comics like should be fun. And this comic was just like, it was meant to be just really, really, really fun, but fun in a way that like horror film fans would consider fun.
Yeah, it's hard. It's hard to keep the spirit of the genre and then also educate people who aren't going to be familiar with it too. I guess that's, you know, maybe I'm not quite hitting it, but you know, it's like you want to try to appeal to both the wide audience and fans of the genre. Like, I'm not a big Grindhouse person, but I know enough about it to appreciate, you know, what to expect, and then also to recognize that it didn't go into some of the more traditional kind of and less tasteful aspects of it.
I don't think you need to be versed in Grindhouse. I mean, everyone's like, you know, stumbled across a John Carpenter film, and he took a lot from the Grindhouse genres. You know, we've probably all seen Carrie, which is actually Brian De Palma, as well as like nicking wholesale from Hitchcock, takes so much from the Grindhouse cinema to put into Carrie. Like that opening like scene of all the girls in the shower. I mean, like really, Brian, like 14-year-old girls in the shower. Good one. Peter Bear approves. He's such a sleazeball, Brian De Palma. He tries to be so like, you know, oh, I'm such an intellectual filmmaker. No, you are a jumped up exploitation filmmaker who's seen a few too many Hitchcock films, but we love you, Brian. It's okay. Like, respect who you are. So yeah, you don't need to see those films at all. And the other thing is like, one of the reasons I wrote the series was the transgressive elements of Grindhouse have been like co-opted wholesale, probably via Quentin Tarantino, into mainstream comics, to make them like more legit, weirdly, that we're all familiar with it. But we're familiar with it in a kind of a bad, like makes you feel ucky kind of way, you know, when the wife of some superhero team gets raped or killed and raped or like gets raped and becomes evil or, you know, this whole use of extreme sexual violence as a shorthand for this character is bad. It's like, no, try writing.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
You know, don't try contracting, try writing.
And a more fun note too, like in terms of writing, what comics are you reading now or have you had kind of a chance to check out recently that more people should be paying attention to?
Oh God. I mean, I'm really only, you know, playing the hits right now. You know, Lazarus, which I've been slow to catch on to just because of money reasons. saga. I still love, which is, you know, it is so trashy, but it's so good. And I think the biggest attraction for me is Fiona Staples' art. It's just so, so wonderful. Velvet. I was reading Fatal, but I've sort of stopped picking it up more again through a money thing rather than a, rather than a value. I'm a big fan of Brubaker's work. What else am I reading? Michelle Fife's Copra. That's probably the most inspirational book in terms of design. The issue 8 where he does the big superhero fight across the city, like that's hands down the best superhero fight in comics like this year. I'm sorry, I let you all finish, but like Fife wins.
So good.
Pretend that was all in caps lock. Right. Also. gosh, what else am I reading? I'm reading A Distant Soil. I love, I think that's one of the great overlooked classics of modern comics, Colleen Duran's A Distant Soil. It is wonderful and it's so cliffhangery. She started that when she was 17. I kind of hate her in a way because it's so good and she was so young and you kind of expect it to be ropey because she started it when she was really young and it's not at all. It's solid. It's so solid. And it's so like just gripping. And after the end of every chapter, I'm like, oh, I have to read the next one. And that's why it's killing me that she's off like doing books with Neil Gaiman right now. Cause I'm like, no, you need to keep writing A Distant Soil. Cause the last one ended this really dramatic. Like, nah. what else am I reading? I've picked up a few other things that I don't want to mention cause I picked them up and then put them down again.
That's okay. Well, I also, I sprung the show theme on you pretty late last night and asked you if you wanted to pick the music. And I know you did. So what did you find that was fun for us about power, money, and women? Tell us about the intro and the outro.
They're not massive philosophical choices, but...
that's okay.
Power, money, and women. I just wanted to, I wanted to pick, you know, female musicians and... Jessie J, who's a British singer. I'm not sure she ever really made it that much into the US, but I'm so out of it. She could have been a big hit in the US and I never would have known. It's got a great video. Jessie J, Do It Like a Dude, which is just both these songs are just hyper, hyper sleazy. Some songs are about like making love and some songs are about sex and some songs are about fucking. These songs are about fucking. My closing song, Polly Perkins's Coochie Coo, is blatantly a song about fucking other women. It was released as a single and then pulled back really quickly once some studio exec actually listened to the words and realized what she was singing about. And she was like sort of girl group singer from like the 60s. I don't know a lot about her. I want to research her more. I originally found a song on a compilation called Queer Noises from the Closet to the Charts, and it was like the token lesbian singer in like with a bunch of gay guys like Joe Bryath and all. It's an amazing compilation. It's kind of nuts, but wonderful. It also has the Smokey Robinson and the Miracles singing Ain't Nobody Straight in LA, which like, go just find that song and listen to it right now. It's not what you normally think of Smokey Robinson and the Miracles singing. But yeah, Polly Perkins' Coochie Coo, that's a song to take your clothes off to, basically. Nice. It has the sleaziest just backing sound. I just don't know. It's like what you think, like before you've ever been to a strip club and you realize they're just playing the hits and dancing to those, like this is what you thought went on at strip clubs, this sort of music. At least I did. Okay, I was woefully disappointed when I heard what actual music they were playing. It's like, oh, you're stripping to Holiday Madonna, really? That's all? Oh Like a Virgin, oh that's like such a big jump.
Maybe you're just not going to the right strip clubs.
Probably not.
And his goals for 2014.
So yeah, the Polly Perkins song. I found the rest of that album. It's called Liberated Woman on iTunes, and I need to do more research on her because I think she was completely out, which is probably why she sank like a stone in the 70s. Because like you weren't allowed to be out in the 70s as a woman, I don't think, at least not in the music industry. But the whole album, like from the snippets I've heard on iTunes, again, this is a I can't afford it until next paycheck thing. Sounds pretty amazing. I've just always loved Coochie Coo as a song. And the Jessie J song is just it's modern, it's fun. It's like, it's about power and sex and doing it like a dude.
Nice.
And again, it's a pretty like take your clothes off song.
Thanks.
My gift to you.
On that note, is there anything else, any last words of wisdom, anything else you want to share with us? This is your chance to be so profound and mind-blowing. No pressure.
Or just self-promotional. Self-promotional is fine.
Always bend your knees.
That's good. That's good advice.
Also,
yeah.
Everywhere you want to go will always be to windward.
Mm-hmm. Perfect words of wisdom. Anything you want to plug? I mean, I know we kind of went over in the beginning, and everyone should go out and buy Grindhouse and
Smoke and Ashes. Absolutely.
Yeah, just generally, if you like what I've had to say and like want to help me out in some way, the best way to to encourage me and enable me to publish more books is to go out and buy my books. Whether you buy them from the Dark Horse app, annoyingly they're not on Comixology because reasons. And that's my one frustration with Dark Horse. They're an amazing publisher in every other way otherwise. But if you go out and spend some coin on Grindhouse, Grindhouse is an interesting structure in that it's 8 issues, but each story is only 2 issues, and the story is completely unrelated, have different artists, and are just self-enclosed. So if you kind of want to see what this is all about and you're not sure whether you'll like it, just pick up issue 1 and 2. It's a complete story. So if you enjoy that, then try issue 3, etc. Issue 1 and 2 are the Bee Vixens from Mars storyline. Issue 3 is the beginning of the 2-issue Women in Prison in Space story, because everything is better in space.
Especially women in prison.
And if you're like, oh, I don't know about Grindhouse, that sounds a bit déclassé for me, try Smoke Ashes. That's a little bit more literary and formalist, but you don't really notice that because it's essentially just an action thriller that with a fairly relentless pace. And it's huge. It's like 450 pages. And it's a proper like novel-length sit-down read, and it's I think it's only $20 on Amazon right now. So yeah, like.
Right, that's what I was gonna say. I bought it off Amazon. It's for what the amount of story you get for the cost. It's almost. I feel bad. I should send you more money or something. I'll keep buying your books.
Yeah, absolutely. Keep my books.
Oh, and Valentine is on Thrillbent. If you just
that's
wanna...
free. Yes, that's free.
And,
that was the big comic I launched in 2009, and it's been downloaded like 500,000 times, and like apparently. It's considered the one of the founding like inspirational digital comics that inspired the Marvel Infinite Comics and Mark Waid and all these people, and Moth City, which is another wonderful comic on Thrillbent you should also be reading. Mm-hmm. And precisely nobody gave me money for it or employed us, Christine and I, to do other like Infinite Comics, even though we knew how to do them really well. And so I had to stop the series when I lost my job in 2011, and it's been on hiatus for 2 years. Simply for money reasons, because, you know, I pay Christine for her art because, you know, she has rent and needs to buy food, and her landlord doesn't accept exposure. I tried to pay an exposure at the gas station. They arrested me. It was really cold, too. They didn't let me take my coat. Anyway, So it's been on hiatus. It has relaunched from the beginning last week, and you can stay with it. And now Thrillbent are actually funding us to go through straight to the end because we've got 10 episodes and they're about already done, which are going to actually be 50 weeks of content on Thrillbent because one of my episodes is about 5 weeks on Thrillbent.
That's awesome.
Then we've got 12 more episodes to go. So it's going to be it's a fantasy thriller epic. It's just a lot of fun. It's super cliffhangery and super twisty. You know, like wherever you think it's going to go when you start reading it, it's not going to go there. Mm. You're wrong.
Wonderful.
Well, there you go. Thank you to writer Alex DeCampi for joining us on the couch this week. This was fantastic, super entertaining, and like quite educational. So if you have been listening to a lot of the films and the books that Alex was mentioning, I will try to catch as many of them as I'm editing as possible and put them up on the site so that you can check them out later at your leisure. Thank you to all of you for listening to another episode of Comics Therapy. Remember to pre-order your print comics and subscribe to your digital comics. And if all else fails, Aaron probably has like 5 copies of every comic ever published ever. So just hit him up and maybe he'll share. Show info is on our website at comicstherapy.com. And we will see you next week. Oh, my soul.
my dreams are getting.